This podcast is brought to you by the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook, available now wherever books are sold. Details at foodallergypi.com. Welcome to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. The topics covered in this podcast are not medical advice and are simply the opinions and views of both myself and those interviewed. While you will hear me make mention of my holistic nutrition certification, you should know that this is not a medical license and you should always consult a licensed board certified allergist. I'm Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI, host of Food Allergy Talk. I'm a holistic nutritionist, cookbook author, food allergy community advocate, and blogger. I'm married with 5 children, ages 5, 7, 10, 12, and 15. My oldest is the only one of my 5 children with food allergies, anaphylactic to peanut and shellfish since he was just a baby, and newly diagnosed with pecan, walnut, oats, garlic, which by the way, is in everything and the hardest of them all, sweet potato, watermelon, and pear. We live in southeastern Arizona where I homeschool all 5 of our children. I got involved in the food allergy community through support outreach and fundraising in 2009, following my oldest child's first anaphylactic reaction. Later, in 2012, I initiated legislation to allow for stock epinephrine to be available for all students in Arizona schools. This was passed into law in 2013. In 2018, I began focusing my energy on reaching out to the food allergy community through my blog, Food Allergy PI, because isn't that what we all are? We're investigators, we're detectives, reading all the labels, finding out what's safe. Where I share my experience there, caring for food allergies, travel, dining out, product finds, and recipe creation. Most recently, in 2021, I authored the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook. Now, I have created the Food Allergy Talk podcast as a way to continue building community and helping others in the food allergy world. My goal is to help you not only learn from my journey and those interviewed on the Food Allergy Talk podcast, but to grow and gain confidence in all facets of living a full, whole life with food allergy, body, mind, and spirit. Health, safety, social, emotional, and spiritual well-being, all of which are impacted by living with food allergies, as well as for those caring for others with food allergies. This is Food Allergy Talk, where you can come to connect and leave uplifted, empowered, and ready for success. Welcome back to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. If you're living it or have a question about it, we are talking about it. I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. On this episode of Food Allergy Talk, I welcome Dr. Omar Wakar. Dr. Wakar is a board-certified allergist that practices right in New York City. He is a self-proclaimed foodie that appreciates the fact that our culture revolves around food. And he wants his patients to feel comfortable knowing what they are allergic to and not to feel ostracized for having allergies. He wants them to be able to recognize the signs and symptoms of an allergic reaction and know what to do, which puts them in control. He did a fellowship in allergy and immunology at Mount Sinai with leaders in food allergy, such as Dr. Sitcher and Dr. Sampson. While at the Jaffe Institute, he helped patients navigate complex food allergies and oversaw oral challenges. Today, we are going to chat with Dr. Wakar about all things testing, skin tests, blood tests, and more. Dr. Wakar, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, thanks for everything that you do for food allergy awareness.
Yeah, and you too. That's actually how I found you. I love watching your videos that you put on Instagram. How did you decide to start doing that? There are some allergists that will get on social media to connect with the community, but not a ton. And so what kind of led you to doing that?
Yeah, no, you know, I see that there's a big need in New York City for, you know, people to get evaluated for food allergies, asthma, eczema, you know, environmental allergies. And I just want to really fill that that role and be the community allergist for, you know, my patients in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. So, you know, definitely having the opportunity to hop onto a podcast like this and, you know, answer some common questions that come up in my office is an excellent opportunity.
Absolutely. And I think it's so helpful because the general community out there, I really do think that they all think that allergies are straightforward and they're not.
Yeah, no.
Just like testing. You would think sure. Testing is straightforward, and it's not. And so that's kind of why we're here today. Now, oftentimes individuals, they'll have symptoms, you know, like, oh, I've noticed I feel like every time I eat dairy, I feel like, you know, I get gassy or my stomach hurts or whatever they're feeling, right? The symptoms that they're feeling. And so then when that happens, sometimes they might think, oh, I have an allergy. Or sometimes they might think they have an intolerance. And that might lead them to your office. Others, such as my son, he had an anaphylactic reaction when he was just a baby and he ended up in the emergency room. And then from there, they told us, you know, go find an allergist to meet with an allergist. For whatever reason it is that someone has been led to an allergist's office, they find their way to you. It, like we just mentioned, it's not so black and white as I think I have an allergy. Okay, here's a test, here's your results, you're allergic to XYZ. What kind of, when people first find you, how do you differentiate between food intolerances and food allergies? Does it start with first asking their history? You don't jump right to the test? Kind of tell us how it starts.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, with regards to the difference between food intolerance and food allergy, you know, if you're coming to a food allergist, we're really most qualified to help you answer questions about food allergy. So when we're talking about food allergy, that's more in the realm of, you know, if someone eats a peanut and has, you know, tongue or lips swelling, trouble breathing, hives, those type of symptoms, that's more in the realm of food allergy. You know, typical food intolerances, like maybe someone is lactose intolerant or maybe they have celiac disease, you know, the skin testing or blood testing that we do in an allergist office isn't necessarily geared towards that type of symptom presentation. But at the same time, getting a thorough history is what helps us kind of elucidate what box you may fit in. And there is some gray area between the two. You know, for example, some people can have nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea from food allergy, or they can have nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea from food intolerance. So, you know, really getting a thorough history is the most important first step in evaluating for food allergy versus food intolerance.
Okay. And so let's say you, because I have coincidentally, I have a daughter that is more as of late recently, we believe that she's dairy intolerant. For that, we just went to our primary care physician and kind of like told him what her symptoms were. And he kind of just told her to avoid dairy. And so that didn't necessitate her going to an allergist. Is what would you recommend if somebody's thinking that they are just intolerant, would you recommend they start off at their primary care physician? Or what should they do for those that are like, oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize there was a difference. And maybe I've been thinking it was different and classifying myself as allergy. Maybe I actually really have an intolerance. You know, where should they go? Where would be the most proper place for them to start off?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think always having a strong relationship with your primary care physician is always helpful. And this is something that they commonly encounter. So they should be able to help you these, you know, differentiating some of these symptoms. But if it's a little bit more tricky or you're not sure, then I would suggest seeing an allergist to get a more thorough investigation. You know, with regards to milk intolerance or lactose intolerance, if you're finding that most of your symptoms are that, you know, after you eat milk, maybe you have some flatulence or you're passing a lot of gas, something like that is more in the realm of lactose intolerance. Whereas if you're starting to break out into hives or having trouble breathing, or, you know, having tongue or lip swelling, that is more in the realm of food allergy. And, you know, really should be tested with skin testing to determine if you need to avoid this food and if you need to have an epinephrine auto injector.
And what would be, so that was speaking to dairy intolerance, but as you mentioned earlier, there could be some folks out there, and you really have seen the numbers, I feel like, skyrocketing with gluten intolerance or celiac. Where would somebody, if they're like, you know, everybody goes to Google, even though they probably shouldn't.
Yeah, no.
Right. And they're like, man, I really feel like they're like marking off all these checkmark boxes on the symptoms of, you know, like celiac disease or gluten intolerance or whatever. If for whatever reason, they feel like they think they might have something of that nature, would they also start off with their primary care and then be, you know, recommended to go to, you know, testing for endoscopy or what would their route be? Because I think sometimes everybody lumps all of this in allergy.
Yeah, no, that's certainly a great question. So when it comes to, you know, gluten intolerance, you know, there is a blood test that can be helpful in helping to evaluate for celiac disease. But ultimately, that blood test can sometimes be sensitive to if you've, you know, recently eaten gluten as well. So in order to have, you know, the most thorough investigation, I do have patients see a gastroenterologist who will sometimes evaluate patients with an endoscopy to evaluate if they do have evidence of celiac disease or gluten sensitivity.
Okay. So they might be able to come to you and then be referred out. Would they also be able to go to their primary care and be referred out? Or what would you say is?
Exactly.
Thinking it's gluten.
Exactly. Yeah. If you're more concerned with, you know, like gluten sensitivity, you could either see your primary care physician or your allergist to kind of start that evaluation. But if it is looking like all signs are pointing towards gluten sensitivity, I would say you most likely are going to be seen by a gastroenterologist at the end of the day.
Okay. And when we talk about testing and you talk about food allergies, People, if they're like on Facebook chat groups, or maybe they're listening to podcasts like this one, they'll often hear the term IgE. Sometimes you'll hear IgG. What are the difference between the two? Why do you hear that term IgE? What does it mean? And who can test for that? And how do they test for that?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So in general, how we test for IgE-mediated food allergy is essentially there's two ways to test for that. There's skin testing and there's blood testing. And in general, skin testing is the more useful and sensitive test when evaluating for food allergy. But realistically, the two tests go hand in hand. The general order of operations is pretty much this. The patient comes in, we get a thorough food allergy history, and then we decide what foods need to be tested for. You know, once that's determined, we'll do skin testing by doing, you know, scratch tests, whether it's on their arms or their back. And a positive test result looks a little bit like a mosquito bite. And we get results within about 20 minutes. Based off of the reaction history and the skin testing results, then we determine if a blood test is necessary. If a blood test is necessary, you know, it takes about 2 weeks for us to get the blood test results back. And then we can make a final determination on if that food needs to be avoided or if the patient should come back to our office for an observed oral food challenge. You know, if the skin test and the blood test are both favorable, that's when we proceed with an oral food challenge in the office. And what an oral food challenge is essentially we take whatever problematic food the patient is worried about, let's say peanut, and we give them a little bit of peanut, a little bit more, a little bit more. And then we watch them for 2 hours in the office to make sure that they do not have a severe allergic reaction known as anaphylaxis. And the reason why we do it in the office is because we have all the necessary medications such as epinephrine or albuterol or antihistamines or steroids to treat anaphylaxis. And that's ultimately how the allergist can clear a food for safe consumption for the patient. Now, the question that kind of comes up is, you know, what's the advantages of skin testing versus blood testing? And at the end of the day, I really do think that the two tests are best performed together. But the advantage of the skin test is that you get answers on the same day as your visit. It's a little bit more sensitive. But the disadvantage of the skin test is that you need to be off of antihistamines for 5 days in order to do that type of testing. Mm-hmm. The advantage of blood testing is that, you know, some new tests have come out known as component testing, which can help determine if a patient is truly allergic to a food or if that positive test result may be due to cross-sensitization with pollen allergy. You know, the disadvantage of a blood test is that you don't get the results immediately. Sometimes it can take about 2 weeks to get those results. And it also requires blood draw, which is not that easy for a young child.
Yeah. Now, I do have a question on the skin versus the blood testing. There was a time when we were in the allergist's office, and because sometimes the blood test and the skin test will have conflicting information. One might say, you know, allergic to whatever extent, or the numbers might indicate that maybe it might be an allergy or whatever, but then the other one not. And I was told that a skin test will then usually trump the blood test. Is that
so
accurate, you know, and why?
Yeah, so when we look at these tests, I think an important determination that people need to realize is that the test is more binary. It can tell you if you're allergic or not allergic to a food, but it can't tell you the severity of the type of reaction that you're going to have. So, you know, that's one limitation that both of the tests have. And ultimately, you know, there are some risk stratification techniques that we have that we can use that use certain cutoff values, whether it be the size of the skin test or the IgE level on the blood test, that help us determine where a patient fits on this food allergy reaction spectrum. And if both of the tests have conflicting information, then we really do need to, you know, anchor on what was the history and what was the size of the reaction. If the size of the reaction was small and the history was either very many years ago or wasn't that strong of a history, then I think proceeding with an oral food challenge is reasonable. But if there is a conflict between the two tests and one of the tests shows a very high level, then I would say that doing an oral food challenge for that food is not such a good idea. Given that, you know, one of the tests is saying that the patient is likely to have an allergic reaction to the food.
A lot of allergists, you know, several years ago, going back to when my son, he's 15, almost 16 now. And when he was first diagnosed, oftentimes they would do a full panel, or you hear about a panel of tests that are done. Can you kind of explain to us what that is? Maybe why it was perhaps a go-to method for some allergists many years ago. And then as we're here now in 2023, why many allergists are kind of not going that route anymore, why that may not be a good route to go.
Yeah, no, I'm really glad that you're asking this question, because, you know, a lot of patients kind of fall into this conundrum. And I think it all starts with good intentions, but it starts, you know, it leads to complications that maybe are due to people not understanding how the tests are performed. So, you know, first and foremost, the most important part of any allergy evaluation is to get a thorough history. Because any of the type of testing that we do, whether it be the skin testing or the blood testing, is prone to having some false positives. And really, in the world of food allergy testing, it's strongly suggested that testing not be performed for foods that the patient is already safely consuming. So, for example, if a patient comes into my office and says that, you know, for the last 20 years, I've been eating egg in the morning and I've never had a reaction to it, then I would not test that patient for egg. Because there is a small chance that there could be a false positive to egg if I were to do the skin testing on this patient. And then the patient may wind up avoiding egg unnecessarily. So that same concept applies to children. A lot of parents wish for their children to be tested for a wide panel of foods, whether it be via skin testing or blood testing. And often these tests are sent with, you know, well-meaning pediatricians, or the parents just really want the testing. However, what people don't realize is that these type of tests can sometimes do more harm than good. So when this type of panel testing is performed, a lot of false positives can occur. And then what happens is that extensive and lengthy testing has to be performed to disprove these false positives. Because, you know, at the end of the day, the stakes are high. If someone is saying that you may potentially be allergic to a food, that means that you may potentially have anaphylaxis to it. And no one wants to be responsible for a child having anaphylaxis. You know, as a result of these false positives, children then develop a phobia around eating certain foods, which can really limit their physical growth from a nutritional standpoint, but also their social growth from, you know, a standpoint of, you know, their friends at school or going to friends' birthday parties, those type of things. Now, there are certain scenarios where the guidelines do suggest for screening tests for specific foods. Current guidelines suggest that for children with moderate to severe eczema, food allergy screening should be performed for egg and peanut. But the guidelines do not suggest routine panel testing. And, you know, I think that's a big shift in the realm of food allergy evaluation compared to maybe, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, where we're, you know, moving away from just blindly testing anything, but really getting a better history and really putting context to the testing gives us more meaningful results.
Yeah. And I think what's important for people to understand, and I had to learn this and understand this just as a mom, a caregiver of a child that has food allergies, but it can even be hard to explain to family because they're like, well, I don't understand. Is he allergic? Is he not allergic? You know? Because it's not so black and white. It's not so straightforward. And so for us, when he was a baby, he was diagnosed with a peanut allergy because he had an anaphylactic reaction to peanut. So there's the history portion of it. And then it was confirmed, you know, with testing in the office, you know, but more recently he acquired a new allergy to garlic. Mm-hmm. And because that's not a top 9 allergen, I don't even think it's a, there's all these lists, right? Top 9, top 14, top whatever. Yeah. I don't even think it's in the top 14. it's more of a not common allergy. Mm-hmm. And so for us to find that, because he was having, he was still able to breathe, you know, so it didn't compromise his, at the time, it didn't compromise his breathing or things like that, but he was like projectile vomiting. Mm. And so, but we didn't know what it was because when it's garlic, that's in like everything. It's in ketchup. It's in the breading on chicken nuggets. It's on. And so we couldn't pinpoint it because we were like, you know, here's the things that he's been reacting to. And it was like so many different things where it's like, okay, well, egg, for example, is in this, but it's not in this. And like, we were trying to figure it out, but it's because it was garlic and garlic was in all those things. Yeah. So it was hard one.
That certainly is a tricky one, especially with something that can, you know, be kind of a hidden ingredient in a lot of different foods. You know, that can be tricky. I think, you know, getting a good food allergy history and taking what we call a food diary, where we kind of, you know, take a look at what foods were consumed in maybe the 1 or 2 hours prior to a reaction can sometimes help us triangulate down to what ingredient is a common problem in all of these reactions. You know, I think that approach is a better approach than a panel test, particularly in children, where, you know, a positive test result really does have a big impact on the trajectory of how they approach food in the future.
I love that suggestion. And I mean, that works for, we mentioned a little bit about, even though we're here to talk about allergies and anaphylaxis, there, it, you know, it doesn't diminish or take away from the fact that a lot of people do have intolerances. And like my daughter that's lactose intolerant, it's not fun. You know, you can't really compare it to anaphylaxis. I'm sure her brother that is anaphylactic to foods would rather trade her for the lactose intolerance. For those that are like, man, I do not feel good. There is something that I'm eating that is making me not feel good. It may not be an allergy, but I feel awful. And that can affect quality of life. It can affect social situations. I love that you recommend doing a food or a meal diary, because mm-hmm. that can help folks, whether they're in, it may be an intolerance versus it might be an allergy. And then taking that into, whether it be their primary care physician that we talked about earlier that they start off with as their starting point, or their allergist such as you, because it, I feel like the history plays, it is the fundamental role in determining a true allergy. The skin test and the blood test are helpful, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like the history is like the most valuable component.
Yeah, no, the history, you know, in pretty much all aspects of medicine is the most important part in, you know, really making a diagnosis, because you want to, you know, have the right understanding of the background of what the patient is experiencing in order to really put everything in the correct context. You know, a lot of times patients who have these like food allergies or food intolerances, you know, it is very frustrating for them. And I think when they, you know, do some research online, there's so many different types of testing that's available to them at the end of the day. And I think one thing that I would want to talk to patients about is kind of the testing difference between IgE and IgG testing, because I do have a lot of patients that come into my office with questions about IgG testing.
Yeah. And you'll see that online a lot where, you know, you're scanning Facebook or whatever, and an ad pops up, food, you know, test for food allergies at home. But usually that's IgG and it's really not food allergies, right?
Yeah, you know, really the short and simple answer is that IgG testing is unvalidated and unproven. So it really doesn't have a role for assessing food allergy. But there is some background that I would want patients to kind of know about to kind of give them some context here. So, you know, in our body, there are five types of immunoglobulin. There's IgA, IgD, IgM, IgG, and IgE. And they all play different roles in our body for helping to fight off infection. So, you know, for the purposes of this discussion, I'm just going to focus on IgE and IgG. So IgE is the antibody that evolutionarily has helped us fight off parasitic infections. And that's what's elevated in patients who have allergies. So, you know, when we encounter something that we're allergic to, these IgE antibodies are what go on to activate a specific subset of cells called mast cells. And these mast cells then release a chemical called histamine, which is then responsible for the signs of an allergic reaction, like things like tongue or lip swelling or hives or wheezing or nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, or in severe circumstances, anaphylaxis. IgG is not involved with this process. So, you know, the role of IgG has to do with the memory of your immune system. So for that reason, I don't recommend IgG food testing to anyone, because the test results are not meaningful. And a positive test result simply means that you've eaten that food before. It doesn't mean anything else. So I really do discourage patients from pursuing IgG testing. And really, if they're concerned about food allergy, they should be looking at IgE testing, which is tested either through skin testing or blood tests.
Because if they take the IgG, they could get their results back and they're like, oh my goodness, no wonder I feel unwell. I'm allergic to everything I've been eating. Well, exactly. Not really.
Exactly.
It's just showing you everything you've been eating. So
exactly. I think that should clue patients into, you know, that test really isn't a valid test at the end of the day.
Right. So that is helpful. And to kind of understand the allergic reaction, it's kind of like your body is seeing something as harmful, but it's like peanut, for example, for my son, or garlic. For whatever reason, his body is confused and is labeling or identifying peanut and garlic as bad guys. So then when they enter his body, they attack, right?
Yeah. No.
They really shouldn't be like, no, yeah, guys, it's good. We're good.
this is actually like a funny way of kind of how we think about things. But essentially, you know, that arm of your immune system, which is overreactive to certain foods and causes people to have food allergies, it evolutionarily was used to help us fight off parasitic infections, which are, you know, mostly infections that we get from, you know, underdeveloped circumstances in our environment. So maybe the water was contaminated, or maybe the soil was contaminated with, you know, these parasites. And, you know, in our developed countries, like in America, we don't have these type of parasitic infections that are, you know, attacking our body on a daily, day-to-day basis. So what's kind of happened is that our body, since it isn't being affected by these parasitic infections, it's using this arm of the immune system incorrectly, and instead is getting activated by either environmental allergens or food allergies. And, you know, there's a lot of different theories that have been kind of proposed as to why this has been occurring. But there's also been a lot of study into this field. You know, it's been shown that kids that actually grow up in maybe, you know, more rural environments, like on a farm or around other animals, maybe not such a clean environment from day one, they're actually less likely to have allergies in general. So whether it be food allergies or eczema or asthma or environmental allergies, they're less likely to have these type of issues. And I think that really does kind of tie into, you know, our theory of this arm of the immune system is essentially being incorrectly activated in some of our you know, maybe suburban or urban environments at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. So my son, my oldest, he's the only one that has actual food allergies. I have a couple of other kids that have some other things like a lactose intolerance, but not actual food allergies. And my other kids grew up and we live now on a ranch with, you know, chickens and goats and cattle and stuff all around us. And, you know, you do wonder, is it because, you know, what in the environment kind of helped them, or is it coincidence? And that kind of begs the question, which so many people still ask, what is the cause of food allergies? And there's not really a definitive answer yet, is there? Like even from the medical community.
Yeah, there's no definitive answer at the end of the day. There are a lot of different kind of prevailing theories, or there are kind of different associations that have been, you know, uncovered at the end of the day. So, for example, they've now started to see that, you know, in mothers that undergo, you know, vaginal delivery for their children, as opposed to a C-section, it's possible that through that setting, maybe the child is exposed to a different set of microorganisms that changes their microbiome and makes them less prone to having any of these allergic diseases.
I love that you bring that up. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I love that you bring that up. That can be quite a hot topic and controversial, especially in like Facebook groups or whatever with moms. And I have always thought that since day one with my son, you know, as I mentioned, he's the oldest of five. And when he had his peanut allergy, me and my husband, this sounds so ignorant, but like, I'm just being honest here. I didn't even know you could be allergic to peanut back in the day, you know, in the early 2000s. I had personally never heard of that. That was new to me. And so then my husband and I, once we did, he had his reaction. And as new young parents, this is our only child, we were traumatized a little bit by, you know, the reaction and what had happened, because you have this perfect little baby. And then all of a sudden it's like, holy moly, food can kill. And as a parent, it's just like natural instinct. You want them to survive and you want to take care of them. Yeah. And so, you know, we just started, as we're not medical field. I have a bachelor's in business marketing. You know, my husband's in business management. We are far from allergists of any sort. But we still asked questions to each other, you know, is it, why do you think this is? And I did have a C-section with him. And when we started studying C-sections and the rate change of C-sections over the years, and my generation and younger, the rates have skyrocketed for C-sections. And so that was one of the things that we thought of, you know, and you hear lots of, and I don't think any question is wrong. And that's part of like what science is, like always question, right? And so to ask, is it vaccines? You know, and that's a controversial thing to say. I don't think it's wrong to ask that question. I don't think it's wrong to ask, is it the C-sections versus vaginal like, because then we can find the answer. And I do want to say that's not meant to make any mom or parent feel bad, because I had a C-section, you know what I mean? But I still want to know, that way I can hopefully avoid that from happening to my other children, or that way I can educate, if that is the case, and we don't know, I can educate my daughters and let them know, hey, you know, if there's any way you can safely and healthily have your baby, you know, vaginally, it might be better for your baby. We don't know. Right. But yeah, that was one of the things that I came across. And so I went out of my way to have VBACs for my other four children. And for anybody that's not familiar, that's a vaginal birth after cesarean. And that's a whole other episode, right? With like an OBGYN or like a midwife or somebody. But, you know, I did for my other four, and none of them have food allergies. Again, is it a coincidence? Is it?
Yeah,
not?
You know, it's very tricky. Like I said, I think there's a lot of different factors involved. And again, a lot of these studies are, you know, showing associations. It doesn't necessarily prove one thing or another. And I don't think that any parent should feel guilty one way or another. I just think that, you know, knowledge is power at the end of the day. But, you know, if you needed a C-section or you needed a certain type of delivery method, I think at the end of the day, that's a discussion that you have with your OBGYN. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different factors that go into it. Even within the realm of allergies, it's not just, you know, how you were born. There's a lot of different factors, such as, you know, how did you have eczema genetically? Did you have a family history where you may be more prone to kind of this atopic March or some of these allergic diseases? You know, was your eczema well controlled? Or, you know, there's also kind of this theory of, you know, a lot of these allergies are maybe due to our children being exposed to things through their skin, rather than through the gastrointestinal tract. And especially for children that have eczema, if they are exposed to some of these allergens through their skin, that actually, you know, primes them to be more likely to have food allergy or other allergic diseases. So I think there's still a lot of, questions that we need to have answered at the end of the day. So I don't think there's, you know, one thing that someone could change that, you know, would make their child more or less prone to having allergies. But I do think that, you know, there's some good research being done that's showing associations one way or another. And I think only time will tell as to, you know, what these associations mean and, you know, what we can do about it.
Absolutely. And I love that you elaborated and bring up, you know, sometimes you need to have a C-section, right? And there's no shame in that, and don't feel bad about that. My sister-in-law, on her second child, she had to have a C-section because if she wouldn't have, she could have lost her life or her baby's life because they ended up noticing during that C-section, long story short, she could have had a uterine rupture. So that's not good, you know? No. And so thank goodness for Western medicine and for all the advances in technology we have and that they can perform C-sections. And again, and I do want to emphasize, because I support all women, you're bringing a life into the world, and however you have to do that by whatever means necessary, congratulations. And it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. But you know, I still do like also asking the question, what is it? Why? And I hope allergists and the medical community still keep asking those questions so that we can find out why.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's other things that we need to look at as well. You know, is there something in the way that we produce food or that we process food that is, you know, maybe causing people to have allergies? I think there's still a lot to be learned. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I see a lot of children with food allergies. And I got to say, the advocacy that I've seen from mothers is astounding. At the end of the day, you know, I think as a community, food allergy advocates have really been able to get laws enacted for more clear labeling of food ingredients, specifically with regards to the major allergens. And, you know, I think there's a lot of exciting trials that are being explored for new medications on the horizon. So I think that the way that we look at food allergy is still evolving. And I think the way that we look at food allergy in 5 to 10 years is going to be different than the way that we see it now. Just the same way that, you know, the field of food allergy has already changed in the last 10 to 20 years.
You know, absolutely. Go ahead.
I think the other thing is, you know, a lot of people do ask me, you know, why allergy? You know, and I think allergy is a very broad field. But, you know, having worked in New York City where everyone is a foodie, I can pretty much walk a few blocks in any direction and hit pretty much every type of like international cuisine. It's a beautiful thing. And as an American, a lot of our celebrations are all centered around food, birthdays, anniversaries, graduations, that type of thing.
Oh, yeah. But they're even like in arts and crafts in preschool. Like you can't get away from food. we just love food, even in our crafts.
And, you know, my goal with food allergy is to clarify for patients what foods they need to avoid, but also embolden them to know how to avoid these foods and what to do if they do have a reaction, because I don't want them to feel excluded from any social gatherings. And I want them to be able to make the most healthy choices for themselves. So, you know, when we talk about kind of like these theoretical things, where did this food allergy come from? I definitely don't want anyone to kind of get into that kind of blame game type of mindset.
Right.
I think there's just so many
don't
different
go down factors. The rabbit hole the wrong way. Like exactly. It's good to ask questions. And exactly. And I think it was great that you brought up our food. And our food has changed. And so I think these conversations are good. And I think the point that you make is also very, very good to keep in mind. Like, this is great to ask the questions, because if you look at it, it really is the perfect storm of change. And so to kind of sidetrack a little bit to express my point, my son, he's on the trap and skeet team at his high school, which is like shooting clay pigeons. And he had to take a safety course. And he was taking the test and he kept getting one answer wrong and he could not figure out what the answer was that was wrong. And so he's taking this test, trying to figure it out. And he's like, well, should I just go back when I retake it and like change all the ones that I think might be wrong? And we're like, no, just change only one thing so that you can figure out and then eventually get down to the point where you find what the one thing was, if that makes any sense. And so, you know, thinking about that and then our predicament that we have with where's this food allergy coming from? You know, when I was growing up, I'm a kid from the 80s, no one in my classroom had food allergies. Now it would be uncommon to go to a school and have a classroom where there wasn't somebody at least with a peanut allergy or a dairy allergy or an egg allergy. And so we look at, we do, and just kind of like my husband and I, it's kind of natural to be like, okay, well, what's changed? You know, like the C-section rates are higher, the vaccine rates are higher, our food has changed, you know, look at any cereal, right? The ingredients are not the same as when I was a kid or when you were a kid. And they're not even the same as you take the same brand of something and it's not the same as in Europe, you know? And it's just asking questions. And it doesn't, and I personally, this is just me, I don't think it's just one thing. I think it's like the perfect storm of a lot of things. And some people are just susceptible to it and some people are not. And that's just me. It's just, you know, my opinion. It doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. Because we have several cousins and they don't have any food allergies, you know, but my kids did have eczema when they were little. And so that did that just kind of predispose them with this perfect storm of different things in the world, 2023 or the 2000s compared to the world as it was in the 80s or the 50s or back in the early 1900s, you know, hygiene, all the different things, right?
Yeah, no, I think, again, I think it's a multifactorial thing. Yeah, I don't think it's related to vaccines. I think vaccines are, you know, an important health measure that, you know, we as physicians are very thankful for, you know, for all our patients. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that there's a lot of different things that may cause these allergies. But I also do think that awareness is, you know, equally important. I think that, you know, through social media, you know, whether it be Instagram, Facebook, those type of things, I think a lot of people are now more aware of these issues. And maybe people have just been living with some of these things for maybe even decades now, and either, you know, didn't want to believe it or didn't want to be ostracized or made fun of for certain things. Because it's not easy for our children to go to school and be labeled one thing or another, or maybe have to sit at a different table or something like that. It's not easy.
Yeah, they just want to be normal. They just want to be included, but then they also want to be safe.
Exactly.
And kind of talking about that. So taking my son, for example, he started off with just peanut and shellfish. The shellfish we found out because... very innocently, well, at the zoo, he got excited and saw that you could pay $5 to feed the stingrays. And I was like, yeah, that sounds fun. And then it ended up in a reaction, which was not fun because they were feeding the stingray chum, which was made of shellfish. But I didn't even think of that. You know, you just innocent. And that's some of the kind of things that when you don't have a food allergy to something that you don't really think about, you know, you just live in life innocently and yeah, let's feed the stingrays. But at any rate, so he had for most of his childhood and adolescence, peanut and shellfish. And then fast forward, and then he started having some things happening and it got worse and worse to where it was like vomiting. And then, you know, we find out about the garlic allergy. How often, because, you know, and this could just be my naivety in not realizing that, and I do know, and I always have known that you can acquire food allergies as an adult, but I really did think as his parent, I'm like, okay, it's peanut and shellfish. That's what you've got for life. Like I just was going through life thinking that's just what he had. And then kind of got, hit from the side. Oh, wow. Now all of a sudden you also have a garlic allergy. How, you know, I think a lot of parents can get comfortable, you know, so to speak, with their allergy and maybe not get testing done annually. Should they get testing done? And how often should they get testing done? And in a lot of places, we've lived in rural areas. We've lived in areas where there's literally not an allergist. The only option you have, unless you're going to drive 3 or 4 or 5 hours, is to get some testing done through your primary care physician. And do you know what I mean? So just people have these different backgrounds and these different ways of living. And, you know, if they are more rural or if they've just gotten comfortable with it and they're like, nope, we know what you're allergic to. We don't need to test. Really, how often should they be getting tested in case things change?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. You know, obviously access to care is always going to be an issue when we're talking about, you know, these specialist type problems. So having a good relationship with your primary care physician is going to be even more important. in that type of scenario. You know, it really does kind of depend what things you're allergic to at the end of the day. In terms of, you know, for children, if they're allergic to milk or egg, about 80 to 90% of those kids will outgrow that allergy. Whereas for, you know, tree nuts, or peanuts, you know, it's less likely that they're going to outgrow that allergy. The numbers are about like 10 to 15%. Generally speaking, I suggest to families that they get, you know, tested, you know, once a year, and that they talk to their allergist as a formal office visit once a year, because there are certain things that can be beneficial in, you know, keeping up to date with your allergist. One is making sure that your epinephrine auto-injector, whether it's the EpiPen, EpiPen Junior, or the AuviQ, is, you know, the correct dosage for your child, you know, because that can change depending on their weight. And that you're reviewing how to use that just in case, you know, maybe your memory is hazy because it's been some time since you've had a reaction. That could be helpful. The other thing is, you know, people who have food allergies, as they get older, they actually wind up having other allergic issues, whether it be eczema or asthma or environmental allergies. And, you know, seeing your allergist, you know, once a year gives you an opportunity to get those things evaluated as well. Now, in terms of, you know, food allergies that can develop kind of de novo, or maybe as you get older, you know, the most common food allergy to develop later on in life is shellfish allergy. But just as you mentioned, your child has started to develop a garlic allergy. You know, these things require evaluation with an allergist. And I think touching base with your allergist once a year is a good timeline to see if anything has changed, and also to kind of see where are things headed, whether your numbers are getting worse or getting better. And does that mean that maybe you've moved from a block where maybe an oral food challenge wasn't possible in the past to maybe now it is possible? All those type of questions can be answered in a formal office visit.
Yeah. And that is great advice. Going back to a little bit over a year ago when he was tested, because the garlic isn't everything. And it's kind of one of those quote unquote hidden allergies that's kind of hard to identify. It wasn't as straightforward as when I gave him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and it was the peanut, right? One of the other things that he was reacting to, and that in addition to reacting, he was also showing positive on skin and blood, was oat. And so we took oat and garlic out. And then he was like healthier than ever and he was enjoying life and everything was great and wonderful. Right. And he got used to avoiding oat and garlic in addition to his other existing allergies. And then, you know, it was about a year time had passed and I said, hey, you know, let's go back in and just kind of see where you're at, kind of like a touch point. Let's just see where you're at. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I don't really want to, you know, and just whatever things are going on, you know, as a teenager where he's like, I don't want to do this. And I'm like, let's just go see. It can't hurt. Right. And mm-hmm. So we did. And, whereas the previous time his oat numbers on the blood test and skin test, like the side, like you were talking about, it looks like a mosquito bite. I mean, his was like a huge welt for oat. It was huge. And the blood also high. And then he took it out in addition to the garlic, felt fine. For whatever reason, when he went back to get tested again, literally nothing. It wasn't even like computing at all in his skin or blood, the oat. Why? Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, a lot of these things can change. Our children's bodies
and that's life changing. Because when he could add the oat back in, like oat is in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, that's where having a strong, you know, relationship with your allergist who has all the previous testing results as well for you. Can really be helpful in kind of seeing which direction you're headed into and are your allergies getting better or worse?
Yeah. And then it might open up the door for you to either, like for him, you know, because the allergist knows his history and is familiar with him and his testing and his history and all the things. And he felt comfortable and confident in saying he doesn't even need to food challenge this back in. He can just add it back in. And we did, and he was fine. And then it opened up so many doors for him, so many doors. And that, like you were talking about, socially and emotionally and all those different ways, because oats and so many things. But then, you know, there's the other side of it too, where for some individuals, it might open up the door, as you mentioned, to be able to food challenge something. And if you can add more things back into your diet, that's all the better, right?
Yeah, that's really my goal at the end of the day, is to, you know, really help patients kind of face their fear and help them determine, you know, what foods are you maybe avoiding maybe unnecessarily? Because that just means that it's going to be less things for you to have to worry about, you know, going forward. And, you know, I think the other thing that is very important is that, you know, through repetition, we learn more and more. And at all my allergy appointments, I talk to, you know, the parents and also the children about, you know, some issues that can come up that maybe you didn't realize could put you into an area of cross-contamination. Like maybe, you know, if you go to an ice cream shop and they use the same scooper for pistachio ice cream that maybe they use for vanilla ice cream, you know, these
or a shared fryer for French fries and chicken nuggets and whatever.
Exactly. So all these, you know, visits are opportunities to just make sure that our patients are, you know, maybe thinking a little bit outside of the box, advocating for themselves. And also keeps them, you know, updated as to any new developments that may be happening in the world of food allergy. Because I really do think that, you know, 5 to 10 years from now, the way that we look at food allergies is going to be different than the way that mm-hmm. we look at it now. And I think that is going to be even more liberating for our food allergy patients.
Yeah, I feel like we're constantly knowing more and learning more. And so maybe some of those questions, because I think it's just natural for people to ask. And even though, you know, no matter where people sit with, like we mentioned with vaccines, right? People still question. They're like, could it be? You know what I mean? And even though it very well may not be, or they still, it's kind of natural to question, was it the C-section? And it very well may not be, you know? But because the medical community is still asking these questions and still trying to learn more, hopefully in 5 or 10 years, we'll have more of an answer, because we certainly don't want any more kids with food allergies, you know, or even adults yeah. with adult okay. onset food allergies. Whatever the answer is, at the end of the day, we really just don't want any more people having allergies, because, you know, when food can kill, that's just, it's really is life changing, and not in a great way, you know, because then you have the social and the psychological, the emotional, the mental, the, you know, anxiety, the, all the different things. Right. So I'm excited yeah. for 5 to 10 years from now.
Yeah,
let's get some more answers.
I think, you know, science is always evolving and kind of always, you know, about, you know, answering, you're questioning things and answering new things. So I think it'll be exciting to see, you know, where the science kind of goes from here. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's, you know, everyone's responsibility within society. And I think that physicians are an important part of kind of helping our patients navigate some of these questions that they have, and helping them to, you know, be educated on, you know, what's safe and what's not safe for them at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And is there anything in regard to testing that you wanted to mention, and that maybe we, you know, got sidetracked and took a different route in the conversation, that you wanted to mention that you couldn't mention, or any final thoughts on testing that you want to make sure that you share?
Yeah, I think just to kind of reemphasize that, you know, I think panel testing at the end of the day, a lot of families or, you know, physicians do it with good intentions. But I think, you know, panel testing, the limitations of that really do need to be understood from both sides of, you know, the patient and also the healthcare providers. And that, you know, without a good history backing up the reasoning for that type of testing, it really should not be performed. So, you know, if you do have questions about food allergies, it may be best to see an allergist before you get any testing done.
That is great advice. And I mentioned earlier when we first started chatting that I came across you on Instagram. So do you have a website where listeners are like, I really like this Dr. Bakar. I want to go find him. And maybe they live in New York or nearby New York, and they're able to actually have you as their allergist, or they want to follow you on social media. Where's your website and your social media that they could find you on?
Yeah, 100%. So in terms of social media, I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok. You could find me at NY Allergy Doc. Again, my name is Dr. Omar Wakar, and I practice in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And we see, pretty much patients of any age, so both pediatric and adult patients. I'm board certified in both internal medicine as well as allergy and immunology. And we offer same day appointments. So, coming to see us should be, very easy. And we look forward to seeing you in our office.
Okay, I'm impressed by the same day visits thing, because if you try to get in anywhere in Arizona, like, it's not happening for at least a month or two. So that's like, that's gold right there.
Yeah, 100%. We try to be, as accommodating to our patient schedules as possible.
That's fantastic. Well, Dr. Bakar, thank you so much for taking time to join me today. Be sure to follow Dr. Bakar on his social media and website. This is the Food Allergy Talk podcast, where you can come to connect and leave uplifted, empowered, and ready for success.
I'm your host, Lisa Horn of Food Allergy PI. Thanks for tuning in to the Food Allergy Talk podcast. Don't miss a future episode. Let's stay connected. Be sure to subscribe at iTunes, Spotify, Google, Amazon, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Pandora, TuneIn Alexa, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, and Reason FM. And until next time, remember, don't hesitate, investigate, and always carry two. This podcast is brought to you by the Everything Nut Allergy Cookbook, available now wherever books are sold. Details at foodallergypi.com.